I was born in Alberta here, a place called Hubalta. Now, that's part of Calgary now. And my dad moved to, had a dairy farm at Rocky Mountain House. And we left there and went to Manitoba when I was 6 years old. And I'd just like to tell you a little bit what things were like then for young people. In 37, me and another chap, in 1937, we got on the freight and we went to a place in northern Manitoba called Gurney Gold. It's a little mining and silver town where they mine gold and silver. And if you wanted to travel in them days, you traveled by freight. That's how you went. And of course, you had to dodge the railroad dicks. They chased the heck out of you, especially in Junction, like Hudson Bay Junction. They chased us real good. I never did get caught. I guess I was too fast a runner, but I got chased lots of times. But anyhow, we went there, and we were at that mine for 6 weeks before we got a job. But we made our own money cutting wood and stuff around town. And finally got on to the mines and got 50 cents an hour, which is really big wages them days. But things are really tough. There's 10 men for every job. And then when war broke out, I was at a place called Portage la Prairie. That's in southern Manitoba. We used to get on the freights. It was four of us kids. We all went to school together. We got on the freights. We'd ride the freights down there and harvest down there. And then we'd come back to our own place in Swan River and harvest there. But war broke out. I was in Portage la Prairie at the time. And they used to take all these guys off the freights and put them in the army. They'd grab them and put them in the army. And there'd be maybe 100. You'd see 100 men riding on top of boxcars on a freight going by. So naturally, we paid our way home. We didn't get caught. We paid our way home. But then when we were home for a while, we decided we'd go back to Winnipeg and try to join up. And we went to Winnipeg. But we couldn't get in. They had more men than they could handle. So we come back home again. And then we decided, well, we'll come to Alberta. And my dad, he liked to travel anyway, so he had a pretty good car. So he said, well, I'll drive you boys to Edmonton. So we went to Edmonton. And we couldn't get in there. We just had more men than we knew what to do with. So we finally went out and we worked at a bush camp in Wildwood for a month. So, and then we come back and they're recruiting for the 1st Armored Brigade. Two of us chaps come in to Edmonton. We joined up and we went back and got their other two pals. And we also got the camp cook. He was a man cook and a real good cook. And the boss said, well, I didn't mind losing you guys. Lost the man anyway, but he sure did not take my cook. But anyhow, he joined up with us. And then we took our basic training. We only lived in a few days and they sent us down to Ontario. We took our basic training at Camp Borden. And in May, they shipped us overseas to England. I think at that time, that was the biggest convoy that went over. And the big battle cruiser Repulse of one of the guard ships that got sunk by the Japanese later on in the war. But we landed there. Oh yeah, incidentally, the first picture we picked up in Scotland said that our ship had been sunk. It's right in the headline, but we weren't. I mean, there was torpedoing going on, but it never hit our ship. But according to the paper, our ship had been sunk. So they put us out on a place there in southern England called Salisbury Plains. And we lived in pup tents there. It was wet and rainy and miserable. And the biggest chap in our outfit was a guy by the name of I can't even think of his name now. I'm getting all confused here. Mike Ivanchuk. He's a Polish chap. We went to school together. And he got sick. He got TB. And they put him in hospital there in England, and then they sent him over to Canada, and he finally got over. He missed all action. So we stayed in England there then until the New England Sicily started. And we hit out for there and we stopped in Algiers for a while. There's some ships sunk. We spent some time in Algiers and then we landed in Sicily. And from Sicily, I went through Sicily and Italy and then over to France and Belgium, Holland, and into Germany. But I think the toughest go I had was in Sicily. That's really a poor country. The people there, they're really, really poor. The land was owned by great big, what we call them padrones, or big farmers, big landlords. And the people there worked their land with hoes and stuff like that. And they have donkeys, but I never seen donkeys pull any implements. They use them in little carts. And it's all mountains in the middle. And us Canadians went up. We went through the mountains, through the center, and the British on the one side and the Yankees on the other. We went pretty well up through the center. That is a really poor country. They grow cotton and grapes and stuff like that there. And anyhow, well, I never got into Germany too far. I was in the Richwald Forest and stuff like that. I was in Holland then, when war finished, and I come back to Canada here in November 45. And that's about my story. Incidentally, while I'm overseas, my folks moved to Athabasca. They left Manitoba and moved up here. That's how I am in this area now. So that's about all I got to say. Thank you very much.
As the vet says, in 1928, I left Wales at 11 years old, landed in Athabasca. Now that's quite a, it was 9 days to come overseas on the ship, eh? Landed in Athabasca on the 1st of April, 1928, and I've been here ever since, the last 3 years I spent overseas. Anyway, I'm 21, I joined the 49th Battalion as a reinforcement. I had 10 days training in Canada, in Edmonton, and was overseas in the New Year's Eve of 1940. And we went down through England, and on our way to Aldershot, we heard our first air raid. The train was shunted off to one side, and the bomb was dropped. All the heavy light was out in the train, you couldn't see a thing, just sitting there like shooting ducks. From then on, we took our training in Aldershot, and all through England, for about 3 years, and then in 43, we hit Sicily. A great convoy from Scotland all the way down through into the Tower of Sicily. There were three beaches there, and they were nicknamed Sugar Yellow, Sugar Red, and Sugar Green. We landed on Sugar Red. Now landing craft took us from the big ships out to the coast. It was just like going on a picnic. There wasn't a soul around. But they could only go in so far, and then they had the sailors out on the big sand dunes where the waves had built up. We had to jump from one to the other. And the poor sucker that couldn't swim, well, if he went underneath, he'd come up just to spot the salt water, which he didn't like too much. But then we got landed, and we had nothing with us as far as he's concerned, just our hard tack and stuff, eh? And we went up in Sicily, hot, there was 100 in the shade out there, just like nobody's business in the morning. And we got in there, and about 2 weeks later, our landing craft came in, our ships and food and stuff for us. But in the meantime, we were about halfway up Italy then, or Sicily. And we got in there, and we had to jump into Italy, and I went swimming in the Adriatic Sea. And on my way back to camp, I thought, nice, eat grapes, and was having a wonderful time. And about an hour later, I was in with malaria. I was about, my body heat was so terrific that I was cold, shaking like a leaf. Went to the hospital, and in about 3 days, I lost 17 pounds. And I didn't know I was even in there. I woke up one morning about 4 o'clock, and the nurse sitting there, Canadian nurse sitting there reading a Western story, said, "Thank God you're alive." And she changed my sheets 3 times that night in my pajamas, and I didn't even know she touched me. I was out cold. So when I caught up in my outfit again up in Italy, there were nothing left of us. Actually, our equipment, we just threw it off. It was too hot, we couldn't even carry it. We was marching up the road, you look back, and the little buddy behind you was laying there. Pulled him up in the ditch, put his feet up on the bank. 15 minutes, the blood was circulating in his back and landing and coming with us. But as we went along, we confiscated chickens, horses, anything we could get hold of from Italians. And we traded everything for food and everyone came out to our outfit caught up with it. And then after we got into up in the real fighting, first met the Germans, then we got into Ortona, one of the big battles. And we took that outfit and we're in there. The 5th Div came and took over from us, and in a matter of 24 hours, we had to go back in and take it again. And then it got on up, so it all went on and went through. And then when the boys went into Germany, I was shipped home. I was the first one to land back in Athabasca. So from 39 to 45, I was out there on the boat. But scared too, besides. Thank you very much.
My folks moved up from Illinois when I was 6 months old, so I was raised down at River Cabar, west and south of Burnville. And then in 1938, I came up to this country and started trucking tamarack and lumber and things. And in 42, I drove a dump truck on the airport in Edmonton when they were making the big runway there, and we were getting 50 cents an hour for driving gravel trucks. So that fall, I got in the Army, and we took training in Edmonton and then Calgary, and spring of 43, we went overseas, and we were in England a while, and then left for Sicily, and the convoy was hit by torpedo planes and subs and things just past Gibraltar ways, and put in 3 months in North Africa, and then got up to our outfit again between Ortona and Pescara on the east coast of Italy. And we were on night patrols for a while there, in behind the German lines, stripping things out, and we got cut off one day and was taken prisoner, and we put in quite a while. About 7 months in Italy, and then they moved us into Germany. And after we were in Germany a little while, Eisenhower made a deal with Germany through Switzerland that they would supply trucks to haul Red Cross supplies into the camps, and a lot of the camps were starving because the railroads were smashed and the Germans didn't have food for the prisoners. And so I drove a month from the Swiss border into the southern part of Germany. We weren't allowed to go into Switzerland because we were prisoners, but the Swiss drivers would bring the trucks across the border into Germany, and then we would take them. And when we took this job on, we had to give our oath to our own, to the Swiss delegate, to our own government, that we wouldn't try to escape while we were on the job. Because if they did, the Germans would shut the deal off, and a lot of the boys were starving. So I drove a month there, and then I was sent up to Lübeck in the north of Germany as a mechanic in charge of trucks. And we took 15 trucks with us, and then they brought in 50 Swedish trucks, and they shipped Red Cross supplies in through from Sweden into the north of Lübeck, and then we distributed them out through the camps. So I was up there for 4.5 months until the war quit, and then we worked 2 weeks evacuating the camps and getting cleaned out there. So we had put in a brief good stretch of time there, and the Red Cross, a lot of people think the Red Cross don't do too much, but if it hadn't been for the Red Cross, there'd been thousands of men would not have come back. They would have starved in the camps there, because the Red Cross food supplies kept them going, because the Germans just didn't have the food to give them. Our ration while we were in before we got the Red Cross parcels was a cup of tea in the morning. That was water, hot water with wild mint they've cut along the side of the road thrown in it. We got a cup of tea in the morning, and at dinner time, we got a cup of, sometimes it would be beaker mango tops boiled up in the water, or if they didn't have that, they would just cut a couple of forkfuls of hay along the side of the road and throw that in and stew it up, and they would make a scoop, and you got a cup full of that. If you got some of the grass, all right, and if you didn't, you got water. And we got one slice of bread a day. That was bread that had been baked in 41, and it was about 50% sawdust. It was just baked up in places like cordwood, and if it was moldy and you couldn't eat it, but it was too bad, you had your share anyway. And one day of the week, we got, that was jackpot day, we got macaroni and horse meat. And some old hay burner that got knocked off on the road, they'd bring it in and chop them up and throw in the cookers. That was it for the day. So we were pretty thankful for what the Red Cross did, and a lot of boys wouldn't have come back if it hadn't been for the Red Cross and what they did. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. I suppose shortage of jobs when I finally did enter into the armed services, but when the war broke out in 1939, I was 14 years old, which was the age of many of you here now, I think. I was attending school in Athabasca at the old brick school, which is still here. I attempted to get in the Army when I was 15 in 1940. I did get in for 3 days, I think, until they found out my age and was subsequently put out. I got into the Army again the following year when I was 15, and I was put out again after 5 or 6 days. Jack Smith's stepfather was the person responsible for that. I then was successful in joining the Army at 17 and was able to stay at that time. But being too young for training, they really didn't know what to do with me, so I was put into what they called a specialist company, which was trucks, motorcycles, and Bren gun carriers. I subsequently upgraded myself in that field until I was an instructor, spent several months at that, and then was sent off to various places to upgrade myself in the same field. Firstly to Ford Motor Company plant in Windsor, Ontario. Later to an advanced driving and maintenance school in Woodstock, Ontario. And late in 1943, I was sent off to Windsor, Nova Scotia, prior to being sent overseas. Now, the people I was with left Windsor, Ontario on Christmas Day of 1943, but I was still 10 days too young, so I had to stay, and I had to stay by myself in this camp until it was replenished with men from various parts of Canada. This was eventually done, and in the middle of February, I was shipped off to England, where I stayed for only 2 weeks, because all the driver mechanics who were qualified were needed in Italy as reinforcements for a motorized infantry brigade, being the Westminster Regiment. Arriving in Italy in March, I think, 1944, we subsequently went into action at what was known as the Hitler Line. It was a German fortified position, which the Germans said was impenetrable. It couldn't be cracked, but in fact it was by the Allied people. My company commander in that action earned the Victoria Cross. The King of England subsequently came to Italy to present this medal to him. Then we had a couple of rest, and in late August, we had another major encounter with the enemy at a place south of the Po Valley, north of Rome in Italy, called the Gothic Line. I was subsequently wounded in that action in September, spent 6 weeks in the hospital, three or more weeks in a convalescent camp, and eventually returned to my regiment. We left Italy early in 1945, February, I believe, went to Northwest Europe through France, to Belgium, eventually into Holland, and pursued the Germans northeast in Holland to the Zuider Zee at the German border, where the war ended in May of 1945, being 35 years next week, I believe. In my regiment, I suppose there were some 800 people in a regiment. There was 135 killed, probably four times that many wounded, so there was almost a complete turnover several times. After the war, I had to wait my turn to be sent back. The longer you had been there, the sooner you came back, sort of thing, on a point system. So I had to wait till December of 1945. So during the interval between May and December, I was engaged in transporting trucks from Holland to Czechoslovakia for a United Nations relief organization. I played some hockey for our regiment in Amsterdam and The Hague in the fall of 1945, and returned home just a day before my 21st birthday in 1946, and was subsequently discharged from the Army. Thank you.
That's
galaxy. I was born and raised in province of Saskatchewan, approximately 40 miles east of North Battleford, a little place called Keatley. I went to public school there and graduated from high school in 1939, June of 1939, I should say. And as most young people, you maybe get tired of the farm or place of your residence and you want to strike out for the bright lights, which I did. Went to the city of Saskatoon looking for a job. Now, nowadays, you either jump on the bicycle and go, or you jump on the bus, or most of you have cars or something to get around, and we had to walk. So I walked 28 miles to the nearest town, and from there on, I got on the main highway and hitchhiked a ride with a big semi-trailer that was hauling gas into the city. After a few days of looking about for a job, which weren't plentiful, I managed to get a job that paid 9 cents an hour, 10 hours a day. Now that don't sound like very much. You can't even buy a chocolate bar for that kind of wages today. Worked there for about 6 months. I did manage to get up to 19 cents an hour by the time I quit. But the army looked awfully inviting at $1.30 a day, plus board and room, clothing, medical, dental. So, got on board train in Saskatoon, went to my manning depot in Regina. After receiving being attached to a company, regimentation and all the rest, we got drafted one night out of Regina. It was about 50 below that night when we left on draft, landed in Vancouver 2 days, 2 nights later. Arriving in Vancouver, it was very warm, pouring rain. Dressed for winter conditions, it was really warm. The officer commanding made us stand to attention, and that didn't work too well because the boys started to faint and drop off like flies. Another order was issued to stand at ease, release all belts, open up the greatcoat fronts. After basic training, Little Mountain, Vancouver, we were drafted out to Prince George for our advanced training. After advanced training, I was fortunate in getting in with the Ordnance Corps, which is a division of the Army that looks after supplies for the Army personnel in the line of uniforms, food, what have you. My job was relatively easy. I was in the office under command of a couple of officers. Stayed there for about a year and a half. And all of a sudden, the push in Europe got great. Japan was putting pressure on the states from the west. Infantry was in short supply, so anybody with a good health record was drafted out of their original position, transferred into the infantry. And I was one of the ones caught in that category. So I got posted back to my manning depot in Regina, went on with reinforcements, moved into Maple Creek for a second shot of basic training. From Maple Creek, we went to Calgary for advanced training, which kind of took, 6-7 weeks, I think. And we were listed for draft overseas, but something went haywire because I think Germany capitulated, Japan capitulated, eventually surrendered, and I was returned home in winter of Christmas of 1945. Well, that's practically my story on Army life in Canada. Thank you. Before I go on to explain the difference between the two armies, actually, I don't know if many of you realize there was two different armies in Canada during the Second World War. And the reason it was formed because on account of Quebec, our Prime Minister Mackenzie King didn't dare have a total mobilization and whoever he felt like send them overseas, because he was sure that he'd have a rebellion on his hands in the east, in Quebec. So this situation was gave the government a hard time, and even the officers in the higher ranking positions came to the point where just about mutiny, because they needed reinforcements overseas, and yet all these well-trained men out here that were called up according to the law that was passed, they weren't allowed to be sent over. Well, anyway, before I go on explaining the situation, about this two type of army, I'm going to sort of give the background of my own, beginning, where I come from, and so on. I was born in Europe, in Eastern Europe, and I came to Canada in 1930, moved in at that time where there was only a few farmers out in the area. It happened to be a rainy season at that time, just like it was last year, and the kind of accommodations there was, they just sort of built the people that we moved in with. They were our relatives that came in Canada the year before. Sort of put up four walls and threw some rails on top, and there's some straw in one corner, so the people are huddling in this corner under that part of the straw, which was leaking like crazy, and the cattle were in the other part, and you can imagine the situation with all the soup and everything. So immediately we started to build a kind of a small shack. It was about 16 by 20. So I don't know how many people, there were about two families, and there were large families, and then later on in the summer, grandparents, my uncles came again, there was some more out of there. So you can realize the situation, and mosquitoes, rain, you couldn't inhale at all, you have to watch because you'd suffocate mosquitoes. Well, anyway, so it was kind of rough. We started clearing land, and then I took my schooling in Richmond Park, grade 7, and then grade 8, I just took 3 subjects in 1 month and completed the 3 subjects, the math and the history and geography. And then I had to quit school because we had to chop brush, and then I had to make a few dollars riding freight, just like the gentleman here before me mentioned. 15 years of age, I was up with freights in the summer, and in the winter working lumber camps and so on. Then when I was 18, I was drafted, and so the reason I'd like to mention this, because why there's so many Westerners like myself that did not join ACTA, because all the most of the conversation that you heard from my relative grandmother and so on, it was about the First World War and the kind of horror and everything, what they've seen. It was about 8 different armies went through that area. So you can imagine the rape and plunder and all the suffering and everything. There was a front lines was only 0.5 mile away from their house, and there was a hand-to-hand battle there at one time, that's just using bayonets. The kind of screaming and howling there was for about 10, 15 minutes. That's the longest that any action like that could last. And after that, quiet. And then when they brought the wounded in there, they were so thick on the yard, in the orchard, barnyard, everywhere. Mind you, they're all wearing, there was, part of our country was occupied by the Russians at that time, part by Austria. So there's guys in Russian uniforms and Austrian uniforms, both talking the same language and begging to get finished off, because they're all skewered, these bayonets in here that you've seen out here. And the kind of situation, you hear those kind of things, it kind of gives you the shakes. Anyhow, at that time, the young people took the suggestions of their parents quite seriously. And this is what we were drummed into our heads. If the king asks you to do a job, you do it, but don't ask for it. So this is the kind of a thing that was stuck with us, because we're newly, at that time, there was a large influx of immigration into Western Canada. And most of these the blunder that I think was done by our armed forces, by our officers, by trying to pressure the guys that were called in, forced them to volunteer. And in basic training, we got in. They started calling names and forcing us, making us scrub boys' hands and knees while the volunteers got passes and so on. And it was a very, very rough reception. So after a while, it started to slow off. It started to sort of cool off, and later on, about 2-3 weeks, you didn't see that anymore. Eventually, these NCOs that used these kind of pressures on the people,
were removed. They were changed around because they seen that they pulled off a heck of a mistake. And that's what caused them to be stubborn all the way through, right up to the end practically, to stay NRMA. And a lot of people that did not receive this kind of welcoming eventually were joining up when there was a sergeant come back from Italy after this battle that the gentleman mentioned here in Italy. They were short of reinforcements. There was about 10% of the NRMA that were stationed in the East volunteered for paratroops, and that's the roughest unit you can get into. So it's not that they weren't willing to fight, but it's this kind of a thing, you know, that it was a couple of blunders. The government pulled off, and then the officers pulled off when the guys first got in. So I took my training in Camrose, and then I was sent to Halifax for advanced training in heavy anti-aircraft artillery, and then I was stationed in the operational battery just on the edge of the side of Bedford Basin. That's that big harbor, Halifax Harbor. And I was staying there about 15 months. And then when the German Air Force was destroyed, they disbanded all the artillery units and a lot of other units around here, and they retrained us for infantry. And then when we got embarkation leave, I was home and then was going back to Calgary again. We're supposed to go overseas. On the way to Calgary, I heard that the VE Day was on, that the war was over. So actually, I didn't get a chance to go over, but there was some NRMA went across, and they seen action, not too many. And it was kind of a sad situation where, on account of this split that our prime minister pulled off, there was hard feelings amongst the soldiers, the NRMA, and the volunteers. Even come to a point, there was some hostilities occurred where they fixed bayonets against one another. Didn't come to actual clash, but just about, but the officers found out about it in time, they stopped it. But more or less, on the average, it was quite all right. You know, they tried to sort of avoid getting under each other's hides. But what I found when I was getting my training in Halifax, for the heavy anti-aircraft artillery, our units were sort of mixed up. There was half of the guys from the west or from the east, and half were from Quebec. And this is one place where you sort of found out that communicate with Quebec is just like communicating with Ayatollah Khomeini. They try to sort of rub it into us to start some kind of a trouble anyway. So there'd be one guy in one end of the hut, laying in the bunk, and the other guy would be in the other end, about 100 feet apart, and be hollering at each other in French. And here, well, okay, so we want to talk different languages. We sit on the bunk quietly and talk amongst ourselves, whether it's Germans or Ukrainians or whatever. And here these guys were purposely on either end be screaming at each other. So we had this fellow here, a French fellow from Morinville, about 6'2", name of Royer. Well, he said his name's supposed to be pronounced Royer, but we call him Royer. So he came up and he grabbed one of them guys and carried him over and dumped him in the corner, and then he opened up in French. I don't know what he told him, but the communication problem was solved right there. So these kind of things, and then after that, when we got into operational units, there wasn't one Quebecer amongst us. We had Nova Scotians and Prince Edward Island, BC people, and all across Canada. They were mixed up in the batteries, but I made sure that there was no Quebecers mixed amongst us, because there would have been trouble. So this is something that, I don't know, this situation still exists. Now you young people are going to be running this country from now on. We're going to get on the green pasture. So I just hope and pray that such a situation does not arise. And if any need come for defense of Canada or any kind of, you know, that you need an army, for heaven's sakes, make sure it's one, and on account of one province, don't split the rest of the nation like we were split at that time. Because it's not necessary and it wasn't fair.